March 2011. This month in Control System Security, I talk with Matthew Yonkman and Daniel Clemens of Emerging Threats Pro. They've integrated the QuickDraw IDS signatures into their signature feed, and Emerging Threats Pro, with some help from Nitro Security, have donated some SCADA IDS signatures for the Luigi vulnerabilities to DigitalBond's QuickDraw project. I'll talk with them about the Luigi vulnerabilities and the related signatures. Next, I'll provide an update on our Portal Edge SIP 5 monitoring module. And we finish with a discussion of securing DoD smart grid projects with Matt Franz and Jerry Gallagher of SAIC. They talk about using DICAP and STIGS to secure these projects. All that this month in Control System Security. This month in Control System Security is sponsored by Schweitzer Engineering Labs, SEL Cybersecurity Solutions, sensible, manageable, scalable. Learn more at selinc.com/cybersecurity. And by Waterfall Security Solutions. Would you like to sleep better at night? Waterfall's unidirectional security gateways physically segregate your control and SCADA networks from all other networks and absolutely prevent access to your critical assets. Waterfall enables easy compliance with NERC SIP, CFATS, NIST, and other infrastructure protection regulations. Learn more at waterfall-security.com. I am Dale Peterson with DigitalBond, and welcome to the March edition of This Month in Control System Security. My first guests are Matthew Yonkman, he's CEO, and Daniel Clemens, head of research, both of them with Emerging Threats Pro. And there's two big things to talk about related to DigitalBond and Emerging Threats Pro. In a moment, we'll talk about how Emerging Threats Pro, with some help from Nitro Security, developed SCADA IDS signatures for the Luigi vulnerabilities, and how they are very generously donating them to the DigitalBond QuickDraw SCADA IDS effort. But that just coincidentally happened the same week that Emerging Threats Pro released the DigitalBond SCADA IDS signatures as part of their ET Pro signature feed. So I wanted to talk first with Matt about what exactly is the Emerging Threats Pro IDS signature feed.
Well, our primary goal with Emerging Threats Pro and with the Emerging Threats, the open rule set, is to be a repository for everything that we can find in the domain that we can write, that our community can write. And then everything we bring in, we convert to multiple versions of Snort, all the way back to 2.4.0, all the way to Snort Current, as well as Suricata, the new IDS engine, and maintaining versions of all of those for in perpetuity as long as they're useful to anybody. So the primary goal is to have whatever intelligence there is analyzed, researched one time, and then published to many formats, with other formats coming soon as well.
I think that's going to be a big help to people in the control system industry, because I know we typically write a SCADA IDS signature for a version of Snort, and it holds up for a while, but then every once in a while there will be a keyword change. I know we had an issue with thresholds a while back, so the signatures didn't work on some of the newer versions of Snort, and then we ended up updating the signatures to work on the new version, and then some people were still running the old version. So you guys go all the way back to 2.4?
That's right, and there's a lot of advantages with us doing this, because if one organization is watching these things, when a new keyword comes out, fast pattern is a good example. In some of the SCADA SIGs, we can actually add the fast pattern keyword and get significant performance increases on current Snorts and on Suricata, but we still don't want to break the signature for old versions. So maintaining the historical versions is still very important.
I see. So it's more than just making sure it still works, but some of these new features actually optimize it?
Yes, absolutely. And it takes a lot of effort to swing back through a rule set, you know, every time something happens and redo these signatures, but it's really well worth the effort. And we have somewhere around 16,000 signatures now that we distribute through ET Pro and ET Open. And it does take a lot of time to do that, but the performance gains we can measure before and after updates are really significant, you know, 10-20% gains both in Suricata and Snort with new directives sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine that's a lot of work, because the SCADA IDS signatures were maybe 50 or 60, and it was a real hassle for us to try to keep those updated. And quite frankly, we didn't do a great job. If you wanted them updated, you had to kind of do it yourself. So this will be really good for people that are running a version of Snort that's different than the one that we distribute, our Skate IDS signatures. So that's one of the benefits and one of the reasons why we wanted to get them out on the Emerging Threats Pro list. Also, you guys are supporting a new open source IDS called Suricata. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. That's one of the things that's really exciting to us lately. The Suricata is built by the Open Information Security Foundation, which my other hat that I wear is president of that foundation. And we're funded by Homeland Security, and we're about 2 years into development. And Suricata, we're on version 1.03, and it's production stable. It's a really interesting idea to mention. Now, it does a lot of things Snort does. And in most cases, it'll be a drop-in replacement for Snort, but you're gaining a lot of advantages. Primarily, it's a multi-threaded engine, so you can really take advantage of hardware that's around there today. Instead of having to run 10 instances of Snort to get 10 cores covered, you can run one instance of Suricata, and it'll spread out and use the whole box. We also do some new things like automatic protocol recognition, so we can write a rule now that says instead of alert TCP and then try and identify HTTP on certain ports, you can say alert HTTP and on any port, and during reassembly, the flow will be tagged as HTTP or TLS or any other thing, and the correct rules applied. So that ends up being a really significant performance gain, but it's also very useful in the malware world where they run command and control channels on HTTP on all ports, and instead of having to look on every port, we can just look at every stream that is HTTP.
Was the performance of Snort the main driver for Suricata, or was it the open source, or what really was the genesis for this effort?
Well, it was something that we always wanted to do, and I have to mention Victor Julian is the lead architect of Suricata. It exists because of Victor. And we wanted to do it for a long time, and DHS, we ran into one of the guys at DHS that wants to do something new and had the funding to do new research, and they didn't like the direction SourceFire was going with Snort as far as keeping it open source, keeping development open, and the fact that they scrapped the rewrite of Snort 3 really raised alarm bells in DOD and DHS. So they wanted to see IDS continue to evolve, and they wanted to see something new. They really wanted to see a multi-threaded and natively IP6-aware engine come around. So things just came around, and by chance we got hooked up with the right people that said, if you think you can do it, we'll fund you, but put it under a nonprofit. So the OISF, as a nonprofit, protects that code. It can't IPO. It can't go into a commercial company. It can't be sold. It's going to be GPO code. It's going to be there forever and protected by the foundation.
It's interesting. There are a few threads between Digital Bond and Emerging Threats Pro. One is a big portion of our QuickDraw Skate IDS signatures were funded by the same organization that funded Suricata. So I think our DHS is probably thrilled that the signatures they're funded are going into a network IDS that they're also funding. And the other thread is Victor Julian definitely is a top-notch guy. He helped us a great deal getting some of the initial SCADA preprocessors done. So we're actually thrilled that the signatures are going to be supported for Suricata and a wide range of Snort versions on Emerging Threats Pro, emergingthreatspro.com. And if someone wanted to have access to these signatures, what's your purchase model there?
Well, we have the Emerging Threats Open Rule Set, which is still free, and it's still a good chunk of the rules. To have full coverage, the Emerging Threats Pro side, we've rewritten all the vulnerabilities for about the last 10 years, and made sure that this rule set has coverage for everything and it's optimized for all the engines. Our pay model is pretty simple. It's $50 per year per sensor, which is about the cheapest in the market, but we have the best coverage, and our focus is really malware, command and control channels, as well as the mainstream vulnerabilities. After about 15 to 20 live sensors on a site, we go straight to site licensing and just work out a very good flat rate. And that keeps a lot of our big customers very happy, and our resellers and OEMs. So we're very flexible. We do a collaborative research kind of model, which, like in this case with Nitro Security, we don't have all the expertise for every possible problem. So we form relationships with other companies that do have this expertise. And when data comes beating on our door, we find the right guys as well as our own guys, do these things together, and that allows us to do a lot more with a lot less overhead and have a better rule set, we think.
That's kind of a good segue into the second announcement here. This last week, Luigi Auriemma over in Milan, Italy, dropped 34 different proof of concept code vulnerabilities on four different vendors in the SCADA world. They're primarily HMI systems, Siemens, FactoryLink, Iconix, Genesis, 32 and 64, Seven Technologies, IGSS, and Datex RealWin. So each one of those had multiple vulnerabilities, and he released proof of concept code. It wasn't the first zero day in the ICS arena, but it was certainly the largest amount of zero days all at once. And quite frankly, writing IDS signatures is something we do kind of as a pro bono when we have time at this point. So 34 was a bit overwhelming for us. We were knocking off a few at a time. And we were just thrilled and amazed when I heard from Matthew that they had IDS signatures for all of the Luigi vulnerabilities. And we took a look at them, and they were extremely high quality. And you said, Matt, that that was a joint effort to develop those signatures with Emerging Threats Pro and Nitro Security?
That's right. On our side, two of our researchers did a lot of work. Dan Clemens, who's on the podcast with us here as well, did an incredible amount of work and took some of the most difficult ones, made real exploit code out of the proof of concept, wrote the signatures for the vulnerability, not for the exploit, and had those up in 5 or 6 hours, I think, whereas it should have been a 2 or 3 day research project. So it's spectacular. And then the guys at Nitro Security, Dale Handy and Brendan there, are just as spectacular coders, and we're able to really understand these vulnerabilities. In a lot of cases, we're not even able to get a hold of the code that is vulnerable, so we're looking at from the outside very much, and they're still able to do good signatures.
Well, the great news is if we were doing this on our own at Digital Bond, it would have taken us weeks to get these done, and Emerging Threats Pro and Nitro Security very graciously have allowed us to release these, which we did on Monday, as part of the Quick Draw Vulnerability Rule Set. So people will have access to these without having to wait weeks. And it is very generous because there are signatures developed and they are available free with registration now at digitalbond.com. Of course, there will be links back to the sites and full credit to the team that developed these. And when we did look at them, one of the things you learn when you do IDS signatures is they do vary in quality, both in terms of efficiency and performance, and also the ability to detect all of the types of attacks in a certain vulnerability. And Daniel, I want to bring you in a little bit now, and since you did some of these signatures, and talk a little bit about maybe the difference between a signature that would just detect Luigi's exploit attempt or his proof of concept code and a signature that would detect attacks on the vulnerability that he found.
Okay. Yeah, this is a pretty common question. I think sales engineers in the IDS world seem to always say one vendor has coverage for the exploits while the other writes it to the vulnerability, and, there's always a big debate around that. And, some of the differences, I guess, between writing to a vulnerability versus an exploit. Generally, sometimes you can make a signature for an exploit very easily because, there's specific, keywords or things you can anchor on that are specific to the author of that exploit. But then if there's five other authors that could have different coding styles and put little nuances into the code, which would then kind of evade that signature. The difference with going to the vulnerability is, it's harder because sometimes you have to figure out, well, what part of that code is triggering the vulnerability. For instance, in the Luigi Iconix Genesis integer overflows, I had to identify, where code being populated for each different option in the vulnerability that triggers that integer overflow. So I would key on those portions, as well as looking at portions that appear to be static in that protocol. You know, and if we move forward and we have more research in the future that changes some of this, we can always change it. But I think right now, you know, looking at where that vulnerability starts to create that chain of events where, you know, there's a call to malloc or a strain copy operation smashes a stack or a heap overflow, finding where that begins is really the first question to ask. Generally, that's going to be the same trigger point in every type of exploit writer's toolkit. So that's where I try to, you know, look at those vulnerabilities and writing signatures for that. And then also, you know, creating packet captures of those events. So in the future, if there's support or we need to, you know, look at QA on, you know, different versions of Snort or Seracata or whatever engine, we can replay that and kind of, you know, try to remember what were we thinking when we looked at this particular vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Now, at Digital Bond, we write signatures and we do some work, but it's far from what we do full time, and we don't have the expertise that certainly your team does there, and it sounds like the Nitro guys, Nitro security guys, have as well. I know Marco, when he was doing it at our place, it was about a 10-to-1 difference. He could write about 10 signatures to find the proof of concept exploits for every one he could write on a vulnerability. And it's almost a different skill set, because I wrote some of the original SCADA IDS signatures. If you take packet captures and know what you're looking for, it's not that hard to write a signature. There's obviously differences in the efficiency of your signatures, but you can write an accurate signature. But in this case, you actually have to not only know how to write signatures, but you have to know quite a bit about vulnerability analysis.
Yeah, and I mean, in this case, you know, I did go through the source code of the vulnerability and looking at some of the debug outputs that Luigi put together. I didn't have the satisfaction to have some of that SCADA code in my lab. You know, looking through his code, it was pretty clear to look at some of the, you know, what he was attacking and how it was happening. And then, you know, I did modify some of the exploit, the proof of concept, to show others how they could do that on our team. And, you know, if you want any help with that, I could help you with that.
Well, that's very nice, but I think we'll leave it
okay. Leave
it to you guys. You did such a good job. So let's talk now a little bit. I published a written interview I had with Luigi, and I was asking him a little bit how long it took him to find these vulnerabilities, how he found them. He gave some answers. He was very kind to give some answers, but it was a little bit vague. I'm wondering, maybe from the looking at the proof of concept code, if you were able to, across this set of vulnerabilities, find some sort of commonality in the vulnerabilities that he found. Did it appear that he was running a certain type of attack over and over again and just finding multiple instances of some software programming error, or was there any other commonality across these?
Yeah, there was some commonality. I mean, you know, the vulnerabilities I looked at specifically were some of the integer overflows and Genesis code, as well as the uninitialized variables and heap overflow. So as far as the vulnerability classes he is discovering, I think they're pretty standard in the industry. It's interesting that, you know, these vulnerabilities are in SCADA for so long. I remember one of the famous quotes from Halvar or Thomas Doolin from Dynamics was, you know, as time goes on, you're going to find different bodies of code, and, you know, they're going to be underfished and overstocked ponds, basically. And I think SCADA and the medical industry are good examples of this type of anomaly and what we expect to have, you know, better quality assurance and code. And I know I'm bunny trailing off in here, but...
No, but that's fine. Maybe, I guess... You look at a lot of different code. Are these errors, obviously they're common programming mistakes, but are they programming mistakes that you're finding in commercial software, let's say in the last 3 years, or has most commercial software dealt with this type of problem?
Well, I think some of the more robust software development shops that do have a good SDLC in place, they don't have a lot of these vulnerabilities cropping up. I mean, specifically, you know, going into uninitialized memory and freeing of double free memory that Luigi looked at, you know, a lot of that will be thrown up as errors in your compilers, your present-day compilers now anyway. So just paying attention to the compiler saying, hey, you know, you need to fix this part of your code, but we're going to compile anyway is you know, a good indicator for some of the development shops. But, you know, I think that these are not really that complex, and it looks like, you know, he took a fuzzer and a debugger and ran with it and just published the vulnerabilities. And so I don't think they're that entirely complex to discover or, you know, exploit.
Yeah, I've been told, not by Luigi, but from some other people, that he's got a couple of tools that he's developed run through software pretty automated, in an automated fashion, and finds things. So if he's saying he did this in 2 days, it sounds like he just used some of his common tools and crank these things out, and they fell right out. As someone who looks at a lot of vulnerabilities and proof of concept exploits, is there anything else that really stuck out or you found interesting about these proof of concept exploits that Luigi dropped last week?
There wasn't anything really, you know, that really stood out to me as being extremely novel. I think he did a great job on what he put together, and I kind of envy the fact that he has a bunch of SCADA systems in his lab and the ability to get those pieces of software to analyze them. And I think he did a great job. I don't see a lot of it being that, you know, groundbreaking as far as vulnerability discovery, but the fact that he can analyze that code with the tools he has is a good indicator that there's more problems out there.
And I think, to be fair to Luigi, I think he indicated that this was just normal work, that this wasn't, he wasn't making it seem like he had done some fantastic research project here to find these. That was kind of one of the things that was surprising, was just how easy and fast it was. Well, I just, again, wanted to thank my two guests, Matt Youngman and Daniel Clemens with Emerging Threats Pro, and just remind everyone that the digital bond signatures, the ones that are available today and the ones in the future, will be available on Emerging Threats Pro. And we do have the Luigi vulnerability IDS signatures up on our site due to the kindness of Emerging Threats Pro and Nitro Security, who did the good work to develop those high-quality signatures. So thanks a lot, guys.
A pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the March 2011 edition of This Month in Control System Security. This Month in Control System Security is sponsored by Waterfall Security Solutions, security for industrial control networks at waterfall-security.com, and Schweitzer Engineering Labs. SEL designs powerful and manageable user-based access controls for both serial and Ethernet control system networks. Learn more about the SEL-3025 SCADA Shield and the SEL-3620 Ethernet Security Gateway or other SEL security products today at selinc.com/cybersecurity. Before we continue with our next guests, I just wanted to announce that our Portal Edge SIP5 monitoring module for the Cisco firewalls and the Juniper firewalls is now available to subscribers at digitalbond.com. And remember, subscription at digitalbond.com is now free. These modules are actually quite simple. The firewall security events are sent via syslog to the PI server. We then create tags for each security event, put it in a security event category, and then display them. So this will help meet SIP5 monitoring requirements, or the modules can be used by anyone who wants to monitor their perimeter security device. You can detect when people are trying to attack from the outside in, or in the case of a compromise that has already occurred, you might detect a compromise trying to call home to a command or control network. And there's a variety of other reasons why you would want to monitor your network and save this information for forensics purposes. In the near future, we'll be adding support for other firewalls, as well as releasing SIP7 monitoring modules. Joining me now are two gentlemen from SAIC. Jerry Gallagher is Principal Cybersecurity Analyst there, and Matt Franz is a Digital Bond alumni, and currently he's a Principal Security Engineer at SAIC. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Morning.
So you guys had a little bit different of an issue than we typically see in the smart grid world. Not only were you deploying some new technology that has a lot of security challenges, but you also had to deal with some of the issues involved with getting DoD approval or approval from DoD to deploy such a system. Matt, what was involved in doing that?
Well, basically, one of the interesting things was, although the commercial smart grid deployments that many utilities around the country are getting most of the press, during the same period of time with the DoD or DOE investment grants, various military installations are also getting energy updates. There's installations of smart meters and things like that. So these are new networks. These are new application components, new embedded components that are being deployed. And as part of the formal RFP process, the solutions that were being developed by the various system integrators had to meet various DoD requirements in terms of information assurance. So we have the guidelines that were based in DIACAP and some of the DISA STIGs that constrained us in terms of whether we could connect to a network prior to accreditation, as well as it told us that, you know, we had to create some artifacts and perform some types of security testing, you know, prior to deployment. So this was a good thing because it helped, you know, all of the members of the team, whether it's a vendor, whether it's the meter integrator or the prime, plan appropriate security lifecycle activities.
Now, Jerry, Matt dropped a term there, DIACAP, which is DoD Information Assurance Certification and Accreditation Process, which I had no idea what it broke out to till I looked it up. And I guess probably most of our listeners here, when they think of federal government security requirements documents, think of SP-800 series and specifically SP-853. Can you tell the audience a little bit, without getting into too many acronyms, about DIACAP?
Yeah, DIACAP is actually DOD's spin on the federal side of the risk management framework, which came out of NIST Special Pub 837. The intent eventually is for both of them to kind of merge, and there'll be actually one standard. So DIACAP is, like I said, DOD's spin on that. It came out in DOD Instruction 8510.01. And similar to the risk management framework, it's based on information assurance control families and subsets of that, those control areas. That Matt had also dropped the DOD STIGs, which stands for Security Technical Implementation Guides. And what DOD does better, I think, than the federal government is those STIGs, those instructions, actually tell you what you have to do to comply with the information assurance controls. So DoD does a very good job of framing that problem set and forcing you down a path to secure your system from initiation throughout its life cycle to decommissioning.
And are those documents, are those public documents, or are they classified?
Some of them are public. You can get them on the Information Assurance Support Environment website that is managed by DISA, Defense Information Systems Agency. And then there are some that are actually behind a PKI-enabled website. So it's a little bit of both. You can get most of the instructions and the directives from either that site or from other websites. And so most of the STIGs you can actually get as well.
So I'll kind of chime in here, and one of the interesting things that I found when working with one of our utility clients is that they were aware of the DISA STIGs and the checklists, so they used this to perform configuration audits of their networking devices, and also many Digital Bond readers are familiar with the Tenable Nessus audit files. Tenable provides .audit files for several of the DISA STIGs. So they are used out there in non-military and also commercial organizations to measure deviation from recommended best practices.
Yeah, and that's a key point, Dale, is that the STIGs, even though they're very DOD-centric and very detailed, they are best practices, whether that's using the Center for Internet Security benchmarks that are out there. The STIGs do go to another level that the benchmarks don't.
Now, we'll include links to the DICAP documents in the show notes here, but I was looking through them and trying to, you know, pick out some areas that I thought the readers might want to focus in on. And I guess to me, what caught my attention was the more requirement-based section. So in Gerion 8500-02, it looked like enclosure 3 and 4 was where they really break down the different types of robustness levels and the different types of controls, security controls that you might have to apply. I guess I'm a little confused. How do the STIGs compare to those lists of controls that you see there?
I might have to step back one. Basically, when you have a system that you're looking to accredit within DOD to get an authority to operate or authority to connect, you establish the initial baseline by selecting the mission assurance category level, which addresses availability and integrity, and then you select the confidentiality level of the data that that system is going to transmit or store or process. So once you've established that, then the government can put in place some supplemental controls, perhaps a specific control security configuration they may want to supplement with some additional rigor, lack of a better term. Once you select those IA controls, those give you your high-level requirements. Where the STIGs come into it is then they go into the actual technology or the application level, and each of those test requirements are kind of rollback or matrixed over to a higher-level control. So the IA controls establish your framework for what you have to address. The STIGs themselves are the specifics in the configuration, and it's not all technical configuration, Dale. Again, this is a life cycle approach, so some of it is procedural. In the federal government, the operational controls, physical, environmental, personnel, maintenance, those are also included as part of the STIGs as well.
And you mentioned that perhaps in the future these may merge with the SP-853. Has there been some sort of crosswalk looking at the comparison of the two sets of requirements?
There is. What the 853, which is basically your 8500-2, does better, it does break them out into technical, operational, and management controls. What DOD kind of does is kind of kludges it together where you may have a control that might have a technical implementation component to it. It may have an operational procedural component to it. So it's not as clear cut in some of the DOD IA controls. But there has been some crosswalk. They don't all map to one to one. Some of them are one to many, and some just don't have a specific crosswalk to it. But that has been done. I don't think that is publicly available. There is a DICAP knowledge service that a lot of that information, if you're working within DOD realm, you can usually get access to.
Okay, and then just one other thing on the DICAP before we talk about implementation in some of these DOD smart grid projects. I'd say the other thing that leapt out at me as I was reading through is that it is quite a formal process to get certification and accreditation. It's something that is taken very seriously, at least based on the procedural hoops that you had to jump through. How long does it typically take to put a system through a process like that?
Well, I guess it depends on who you're working with. When you start bringing in commercial vendors that perhaps have never had to adhere to a more formal compliance process, and then you start levying all these additional requirements on for their system, whether it's a database, a web server, at the OS level, then they have to kind of go into that discovery on their own to figure out what breaks and what doesn't, what they can do and what they can't. So I would say anywhere from, if you were to start right from scratch to fully getting your authority to operate, it could be anywhere from six months to a year. A lot of that is in the security design and development and the testing before you actually submit, but that's probably realistic.
The other thing I would add is that, you know, if you think of, you know, the role that SAIC played in these projects was as the security architects and the engineers up front that were part of the design team, just as, you know, within a utility, cybersecurity engineer might develop a security architecture, the ports protocols and, you know, services and things like that for NERC SIP artifacts. You know, we were doing that work ahead of time and testing the systems, and then there is an independent validator, which would be the, you know, like a NERC WEC auditor that would come in and do the testing and review the documentation. So, you know, to the maximum extent that you can do the work ahead of time, working with the vendors from the upfront, saying, hey, we know you're using this database, you know, commercial database, therefore, the STIG applies for that database, or you're using a web server, a web application, therefore the web application security STIG applies, and you can socialize that and start testing as soon as possible, because as Jerry said, and should be no surprise, you know, some of the smaller automation vendors are not used to the world of security testing or information assurance and specific requirements. So it really helps to have somebody up front, you know, poking the vendors, say, hey, this is coming, and we need to resolve this sooner or later, or your system is not going to be able to become operational.
Right, and that sounds like a good place to jump off into an actual, you know, talking about some of the projects. I know we can't get into the specifics on who the projects were for or exactly what, you know, solutions were deployed, but we can talk about them in general terms. So you have this opportunity to put in a new smart grid network or new smart grid application for DOD, and you go to these vendors and you hit them up with some of the security requirements. What kind of reactions did you get from the vendors?
Well, I think it's more, first, it's always the kind of awareness and the kind of acronym phobia and the fear of the unknown. But the one thing I will say is that the vendors that we worked with were part of a project team where we were all, you know, from the beginning, the RFP came out and the security requirements were identified up front. You know, one of the holy grails of control system security is, you know, get it in the RFP, get it into the acquisition product and process, and we had that up front saying, hey, you're going to have to meet certain IA requirements. So, you know, they knew that it was coming, so it was not a surprise. So, but we definitely did have to kind of break it down and explain, okay, how, as we made our architectural, you know, decisions, you know, there are some kind of guiding principles, you know, as we, you know, where we put components, what is the network segmentation, you know, where do we put security devices. But, you know, as is in the case of any projects, there are always, you know, cost restraints, and you have, and the perfect security solution would be completely unusable and unmanageable. So it's always a balancing act.
And when you talk about the RFP, did you typically include just high level references that you would that the vendors would have to be accredited and certified to these certain DOD standards, or did you actually get down into the security requirements, saying you're going to need this control for information or meet this for confidentiality? How detailed did you get, and were they ready in their RFP responses to answer that level of detail?
Well, I guess let me kind of clarify the government put out an RFP, and we respond that, you know, maybe had a couple of paragraphs, maybe a page on what are the information assurance requirements as it applied to a new smart grid deployment. So they were spelled out for the project team, and then when we wrote our technical proposal and developed our, you know, preliminary engineering design, we kind of took it to another level of, you know, based on our in-depth knowledge of the controls. So
yeah, generally, Dale, the RFP seemed to be very broad. It says, well, you'll accredit this, you will, if you're using wireless, you will follow this DOD instruction. So it's not that specific. Obviously, in responding to the RFP, the more information you can give to show that you understand the process, better for you. But the real work really becomes once you get the award and then you sit down and say, okay, what does this mean fundamentally for us to get from point A to point B to start this, not only this system engineering, but the security engineering part of this process.
But you must have at least some idea of the architecture and how you're going to meet those security controls when you respond. It would seem to be a big trap if someone wasn't familiar with this these broad-level DIACAP requirements that they're going to have to meet, and they respond, and then all of a sudden they realize, oh, my God, that little page meant I'm going to have to do all this type of work, and I'm going to have to design my system this way. It sounds like there was quite a bit of work in just determining how you wanted to respond, let alone the architecture and everything else.
Without a doubt. I mean, and that shows your knowledge. I mean, that's one of the discriminators, obviously, is that you understand the process and what it's going to take. And here's how we're going to approach our solution, to get this accredited. There have been, not necessarily for this, but RFPs, that you're talking about a possible trap is you must be able to credit your system. Well, that's very open-ended, and if you walk into that not knowing what the back-end effort's going to be, you may win it, but you may be woefully inadequate in resourcing it.
Yeah, I guess one of the other, and this all started for me about, a year and a half ago with the first project, and we've been through a number of different proposals and proposal wins with the same team, so we've become intimately familiar with the meters and the meter data management systems and the relational databases that are part of that and the underlying operating systems and the different components. So obviously it was a little harder up front, but now that we've been through the cycle and the members of the team know that, and then, as we have different technical requirements for new proposals at different bases for different armed services that may have slightly different processes, we're able to say, okay, well, if we put this sort of, Ethernet serial gateway here and it communicates over a certain kind of protocol or communicates backwards into our communication server or something like that, we can kind of raise the flag when we're even looking at that proposal, at potential solutions. And, because we've been working with the whole team for so long, and we have a prime that really appreciates the need for information assurance and doing it right, we can kind of avoid some of the problems. But, particularly when you're in this should be no surprise, when you're dealing with some of these smaller vendors that often use OEM equipment, if you have a data collection device that may pull in pulses from a steam meter, records it on a solid-state device, that then has an Ethernet serial gateway and a proprietary protocol, that you start asking them, okay, how do I turn off the Telnet or only have HTTPS, because they didn't manufacture that component for that Ethernet serial gateway, they'll go, huh? So we did have, there is definitely some traps along the way, but fortunately we were able to resolve most of those issues and get it in a good enough state.
In the NERC SIP world, which I know you guys are familiar with a little bit, there's been a lot of, I think, legitimate negative feedback that really what's happening there is an effort to be compliant rather than achieving a lot of security. Not that security improvements haven't taken place. People are securing their perimeters and other things that they wouldn't probably have done without NERC SIP, but it seems as time goes on, it becomes much more of a compliance effort than a security effort. And Matt, when we were exchanging emails on this, what really caught my attention was you said that here in this case, in some of these projects, you've been able to use compliance to achieve security and force or encourage vendors to secure their systems. Can you give me some examples of that?
If you look at any of the compliance or control frameworks, whether that's 800-53, NERC SIP, or any of the ISO, to me it's just as much about the spirit and the way that you view these best practices as a broad framework and something that you need to think big picture about how you can use it to achieve your security objectives and to flesh out the architecture. Because if you focus on the controls in too low level of detail, and you tend to not, in my opinion, not be able to see the forest for the trees. And I think that there's that perspective in NERC-SIP, and sometimes even if you have auditors that don't fully understand how the system works, what's the purpose of it, you can get so narrowly focused on what is the paperwork and what is the process. So I think it's about how you approach the process going in, and if you view it as a way to put some, to enforce a process and provide some structure to, you know, basic security best practices, if you go into it that way, instead of viewing as you have to follow everything to the letter. Now, you are meeting it, but in many cases, we chose to exceed it. And to you make inferences, if we have to do this, okay, then we need to do other activities. For example, there was nothing in DIACAP that said when we were working with our meter integration team and our prime to select a number of commercial and industrial meters, there was nothing in DIACAP that said we need to do some preliminary security testing to evaluate those components. But we knew that we had to document ports, protocols, and services and the security attributes of those. So prior to even selecting our meter, we had basically a mini security testing bake-off where we did port scans, protocol analysis, and identified, you know, what is the attack surface of all these different meters. And nothing in the, if we'd followed the process to the letter of the law, we would have just waited until the independent validators come in and then, oh, well, we have all these problems. But we thought ahead based on, you know, what data we had to capture, and we gathered that prior to selecting the components that we made up our system. Jerry, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, he brings up a good point on, you know, there is a specific control on ports, protocols, and services, and if you were to just go with the STIGs, you're never ever going to touch those meters. But the intent of that particular control and the implementation is that you don't have any unnecessary services running anywhere within your enclave. Regardless of whether or not there is a STIG for a component or not, you turn it off, you document what you need and why you need it, and everything else has been disabled. And so, as Matt indicated, that security bake-off is assessing what we can do, how well we can secure that attack service by turning off things that are unnecessary and giving another potential avenue for attack.
This DIACAP process and these STIGs that you mentioned, are they specific? Are there any specific ones for control systems, or are they just general for information systems, Matt?
So, I mean, if you go to the DISA site, you'll see, you know, Oracle, Tomcat, you know, Cisco, Juniper, you know, you will not see a PLC STIG, you will not see a meter data management STIG. But, you know, given that many of the components, particularly if you're dealing with TCP/IP devices or on general purpose operating systems, you know, if your meter data management system is using a given relational database, you have a number of checks that you have to harden that database. So those all apply. And if you have a web server, those all apply. And if you're implementing, you know, perimeter access controls in a switch or a router, or if you're implementing a, you know, an 802.11 wireless network, you know, you have specific, you know, for the network infrastructure devices, they definitely apply. However, what I did do is I went through some of the non-traditional networking devices for voice over IP, and I looked at some of the requirements there and kind of used those as an inference of, like, okay, well, how would I apply those to a controller device? So I guess the point is that there's not specific technical guidance in terms of, you know, what you should have on your PLC or your controller, but, you know, the general best practices, if you think creatively, you can apply those. And the other point I would say is that, you know, you need to really have a, and this is something that I'm, in the DoD world, the energy managers and the utility guys have the same complaints as in the commercial world, you know, with their IT shops and with the information security shops. So just as in, you know, the commercial world, you have to kind of help bridge those communities and have someone that, you know, has a deep understanding of how these applications and how these AMI systems function and can, you know, explain the purpose of these systems so you can make logical, just, you know, security recommendations and, you know, applications of the requirement versus just treating these as any other system.
Jerry, are there any major differences you see with a DoD smart grid system as compared to, a commercial utility smart grid system?
I probably don't have the back-end knowledge, Dale, to be quite honest with you, to apply that or make any inferences. So I would have to defer to Matt. However, moving forward, at least within the DoD, like I said, it's pretty well framed on the path you have to go. And kind of to capture and jump on what Matt was saying as far as making inferences, you know, you've got your specified, this is what we have to do. Then you have to kind of sit back and analyze and say, what are our implied tasks, okay, that are perhaps not covered in a specific check, but needs to be applied to the system in its entirety.
Matt, do you have any thoughts on that?
So the applications that we were looking at were more, first of all, more commercial and industrial metering, as opposed to the residential metering. So we're dealing, you know, if you're putting a meter on a transformer or on a large, you know, building on a military installation, you're going to have a smaller number of meters than you would if you're putting one on every house. So, in some sense, the scale of a deployment is smaller. Also, you know, as most folks know, many of the concerns with residential meters is when you're putting customer premise equipment is physical security.
Right.
The systems that we were deploying were often in locked enclosures, and you know, you have some assumptions about when you're on a military base about what the physical security posture is. Those would be some, you know, just in terms of the scale of and complexity of the deployment, in terms of the number of meters, as well as the some of the physical security, systems that are available on base that you really wouldn't have in a residential area.
I guess just to close, then, is it fair based on our discussion and our emails? I guess I get the sense that both of you feel like this, in this case, having to meet this certification and accreditation actually improved the security of the systems that you're deploying. Is that a fair characterization?
Without a doubt, I think so, yes.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll say, I would agree as well, but, you know, there are valid complaints about the CNA process that it can be a paper game, it can be a checkbox activity, as any compliance activity can be, and it definitely requires you to struggle against the various artifacts and the bureaucratic processes that are often in place. So I can, if you don't have a strong will, you can be kind of subsumed into the bureaucracy and the process, but you really have to kind of focus, what is the end goal of what you're trying to accomplish here? And that's to, you know, design and deploy and operate a secure system versus just thinking about what are the documents I have to create in the checkbox.
Yeah, and what I like to refer is that the P and die cap, Dale, is not package, it's process. And it is a life cycle process from initiation to decommissioning. So, and there are a lot of things that kind of feed into it that I think the NERC SIP kind of touch on, but certainly on the federal side where you get the continuity of operations and those type of things, those are all things that have to be considered and be included in that process. But to kind of jump on what Matt said as far as the package, I've had people say, well, you guys put the package together. Well, the P isn't package, it's process.
Okay, well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm sure this gave people a view into an area that most of our listeners had never even dealt with before.
Thank you, Dale. Appreciate your time.
Well, that's the show for March 2011. I want to thank my guests, Matthew Yonkman and Daniel Clemens with Emerging Threats Pro, and Jerry Gallagher and Matt Franz with SAIC. Remember to subscribe to the RSS feed at digitalbond.com and follow us on at Twitter. We are at digitalbond. And one last note, we do have an ICS security tool mailing list, which highlights all the research tools that Digital Bond and others produce. This month in Control System Security is sponsored by SEL. SEL Cybersecurity Solutions, sensible, manageable, scalable, at selinc.com/cybersecurity, and Waterfall Security Solutions, security for industrial control networks, at waterfall-security.com. I'm Dale Peterson, and we'll see you next month on This Month in Control System Security.